Welcome, coaches and fellow split talkers. Thanks for jumping in again to the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Officer at Basketball Victoria. Joined with me, I have Zoe Carr, the High Performance Coach for the Vic Country Women. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here today.
So you should be. This is a great guest we've got coming in today. And I must say, under no duress whatsoever to appear on the podcast. Thank you very much, Tony Sleep. Not the case. Zoe volunteered to do this. The accusation that it was under duress, not appreciated, but you'll be okay, Tony. Coaches, thanks very much for jumping in once again. You can get us on the hashtag Talking Split via social media if you need us. You can send us an email if you need to do that. But any like, share, retweet, anything like that would be fantastic to help grow the podcast. Incredibly lucky this week with our guest, the great Warren Brown.
What a guy.
You can't do anything without Woz knowing about it, and big supporter of the podcast. And this week he's hit us up and said, look, I've got someone I think you should be on the podcast. Not himself. When I roll through this this gentleman's list of credentials, you'll sit there and say this is a high quality addition. Basketball New South Wales Hall of Fame member, head coach of the basketball at NSWIS for over 10 years, over 300 games coaching the NBL as the head coach of West Sydney, Sydney Spirit, Perth Wildcats, Illawarra Hawks, Nike basketball camp director with the Nike Hoop Summit head coach of the men's World University Games in Italy as they jagged a bronze medal last year, assistant coach with the Australian Boomers at the Athens Olympics, the Melbourne Commonwealth Games and the Japan World Champs, head coach of the Scottish men's basketball team, where they make quarterfinals at the Commonwealth Games. 2003 World Junior Championships gold medalist, which is big time.
Yeah, not many of those around.
Not many of those at all. Co-author of the new book, When Winning Matters, which is available for pre-order, and we'll get into the details for all our coaches. Really excited to have Rob Beveridge with us today, who has, as we just mentioned, just started writing a book, When Winning Matters, with Stephen Bird. How do you know Stephen Bird for a start, and how did you decide to write the book together?
Yeah, so we've actually written the book. The book's pretty much done. We finished a few weeks ago and it's off at the publishers and stuff like that. And so Dr. Stephen Bird, or Birdie, as he's known as, he's a very, very high-credentialed, well-respected performance scientist, background in sports science. So I actually met him back in my Perth days, probably over 10 years ago now. Where he was actually working with Brett Coxedge, who was the high performance manager of WA basketball. So he came over to do some workshops with those guys, and I met the guy there, and straight away, this guy's he's special. It's one of those things that everything that I've ever done in my life is I always want to work with great people. So within probably a 48-hour thing, I went to our CEO and said, hey, there's a guy here I want to utilise for our program. That was one of the benefits of the Perth Wildcats, that we could do stuff like that. So he was actually an associate professor at a university back in those days at Charles Sturt University. So we organised to fly him over regularly to work one with me, the team, but also mentoring a guy called Will Markwick, who's our strength conditioning coach. Birdie's got an extensive background, world credential, particularly in the performance side of things, preparation, recovery, things like that. So really, he's been my right hand man for a long time now. So everywhere I go, he goes, and we've spoken about it in the past about, hey, what can we do to, we consider ourselves mentors now, and it's one of those things. I had great mentors that helped me. I think I'm at a stage in my career where I now want to pass on as much as we can. So we basically said, all right, let's write a book and about our 25 plus years of working in high performance, everything from the juniors. I think collectively we've been to four Olympic Games. I think it's 9 World Championships, Commonwealth Games, all of those things. So we've got extensive experiences in different areas. We've both worked internationally, and so we've put together a book. If I do say so myself, I think it's pretty good, and covering everything for athletes, coaches, and organisations. So there's each chapter will have different things, but it's all catered at what elite coaches do, elite athletes, programs, successful programs, not successful programs, what we've learnt. And we're just passing that information on and trying to get it out to not only sport, but the community as well.
Absolutely. And I've seen a couple of the chapters have been released and things like that, and it looks like a phenomenal read in general. Like, it's not necessarily just for basketball people. That's the big thing. It's for sport people everywhere that can take something and learn about how can they do their thing better. What did you enjoy most about writing the book?
Well, we've sort of split it between the two. So I've done probably on my strengths of building organisations, building teams, cultures, developing players. And Bertie's got extensive background on the sports science things of the everything from the psychology through to the strength conditioning, all of those things there. So, I enjoy just really passing on things that I've done with, the Andrew Bogarts and Damian Martins and, working on, with the international program, working with elite players. Look, this is what they do. And if you want to be elite, this is the type of thing. So I really enjoy passing on, information about what the great coaches, the great players, you look at Phil Jackson, you look at Greg Popovich, I look at why they're so successful. And, I think coaching in particular, a lot of it, it's to do with plagiarism. You go and steal other people's ideas and you take what you can and apply it to yourself and your personality. And so that's what we've done is, pretty much stolen a lot of things. Of course, we add our own things in and apply it what works for us. And that's pretty much what we've done. And, I guess mine is athlete development, skill development, building programs, athlete-player relationships. That's what I enjoyed the most.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a great read. I've already pre-ordered a copy, so I'm looking forward to getting mine when it rolls through. How can other people get a hold of the book?
Yes. So right now we've just started, what we call our marketing campaign, if you want to look at it that way. So we've got a Facebook page called When Winning Matters. It's a private group, and we're close to 2,000 members in less than 2 weeks, which has been really, really good. So on that Facebook page, there's information. Each week we have our own podcast, just information about each chapter. We release information each week about what's in the chapters, and there's links on that. On that page, very, very simply, just click the button. It'll take you to the shop or whatever it might be, and you can go from there. But also, what we've done is you can only do so much in a book. You got limitations and things like that. So we've also got what we call is the MVP room. Most valuable points, where you can actually go into that. So once you buy the book, you can actually go onto the website and it brings up other information. So stuff that we couldn't put in the book, you can actually access, things like recovery programs, sleep hygiene programs, different stuff that I do when I evaluate my players. So rather than having like forms actually in the book, you can click on the link and you can download that. So for athletes and coaches as well.
Yeah, and it looks fantastic. I had a quick look through the resources that came through this morning as well that were a part of it, and it is a fantastic resource for a lot of people, in particular the recovery side of things. And what we know we're dealing with athletes at the moment that are potentially going to be going through a lot of recovery over the next sort of 4 to 8 weeks. A lot of that information is really valuable, I think, for coaches to have a little bit of an understanding of. It's not that we take away from the skill development, but we're looking to add to the coach's toolbox as well and say, well, learn more. It doesn't mean that it has to stop with basketball.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the whole thing. We're all students of the game, and we're just passing on information, and people have done that for me, and we're doing it for others now.
Bevo, apologies if I get a little fangirly while I'm asking you the questions. I've followed you as a coach for a very long time, so it's very exciting to be able to speak to you. You mentioned before you had some great mentors that helped you with your coaching and helped you through your journey. Who were they? Were they all basketball people or basketball-specific people, or did you look outside of the sport? And how did they really help you grow as a coach and help you with your experience and with your journey?
They're huge, and you know, I can't emphasize it enough that I think we as coaches, you know, as you get older, you feel that obligation to be able to help people. And I was very, very lucky when I came through the coaching side of things that, you know, one of my best friends was Guy Malloy. And, you know, we actually, you know, went to uni together, lived together, we coached together, types of things. So, you just, by surrounding yourself with people like him, my early journey, it was the Patrick Hunts, the Adrian Hurleys, the Phil Brown, Gordy McLeod, all of those types of people, they took me under their wing in the early 90s when I worked at the AIS and with programs, that they really helped me. And then as your journey evolves, you need to surround yourself around really good people. So, I left Canberra at the AIS, great people. I went over to Perth to work with directly with Guy Malloy at the Perth Breakers and also Adrian Hurley at the Wildcats. Just learning from those guys on how they do everything. There's more to it rather than just skill development, physical development, but it's how you can build a team, how you handle personalities, organization, money, fans, sponsors. There's so many things. So that was wonderful. And further on, Warwick Cann up in Queensland, he was my boss when I was up there with the ITC program, it was called back in those days. And he's to this very day, you stay in touch with these people, and they help you along the way. But what I found is, I like to talk to other coaches. When I was at the New South Wales Institute of Sport, I was there 10 years. So you're sort of cross-pollinated with everything from the hockey coach to the cycling coach to the water polo, soccer. It just went on. So we had regular monthly meetings, and that might end up in let's go for lunch, let's have a chat, let's have a coffee type of thing. And you don't specifically talk about, the skill, the X's and O's or anything like that. It's about bigger issues, how you handle athletes and parents and stuff like that. So that was really, really good. And then, when I got into Perth, I was very lucky to get involved with the Eagles with John Worsfold. You meet with John Worsfold and Rick Charlesworth and, people like that. So, and these people are just normal people. People put them on pedestals, but they're just normal. And I met a sponsor who was a high profile lawyer. So, again, it's nothing to do with sport, but the same principles apply when you're managing people and things like that. So, my whole life has pretty much been surrounded by mentors. It's simple as that.
Did you approach them, or did you find that they maybe saw something in you, saw your potential as a coach, especially when you were a younger coach, because you got into coaching quite young? So did you find that they sort of approached you and grabbed you and took you under their wing, or did you have to approach them and ask for the help? And if you did approach them and ask for help, how did you go about that when they are people that, like you've said, are potentially put on pedestals?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I was very, very driven from a young age that, I had this desire and goal to be a coach. And, I went through the University of Canberra, did their sports coaching degree. And part of that was you had to do practical experience. I think it was 100 plus hours or whatever it might be. So you start off that, but that's only a number, I was lucky because, living in Canberra, I could go to the AIS. So I did all the extra bits and pieces. So I'd go in the morning and I just ask questions. And I think that when coaches see your passion and you want to learn, and that they will take you on your wing. So say, hey, can I come to this session? Can I do that? Can I help rebound? Whatever else. And, I think you find that, it's probably from my end, I showed the enthusiasm, the passion to do it. And I think, as coaches, I think that we just love to give back, and it's about developing relationships. And Patrick Hunt was my mentor during the AIS, and you wouldn't meet a better man that wants to help. you know. So he would take you under the wing, and you could easily talk up. You can pick up the phone and chat. So really, it was a combination of me being proactive and showing enthusiasm. And I think in return, coaches, they see that, and you go from there. I mean, to be able to get together with Rick Charlesworth, and you know, you just develop the relationships when you meet these people. You know, a lot of us are like-minded, and you know, I find that the very, very best coaches don't have huge egos. You know, and that's what I've learned. I mean, those that do, I don't really want to be around anyway. You know, so I think that that's probably a combination of me being enthusiastic, and then secondly, people identifying, hey, you're not a bad guy, let's go and have a chat and have a coffee. It just goes from there. Yeah.
Did Pat ever sing for you?
Oh, too much. Too much from the you'll never forget the top of the office at the balcony. AIS, you would have heard him bellowing out Pavarotti.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think he's done that with hundreds of times. He would have done that.
It's really interesting you hit on the mentors, but that helps build your coaching network too. And that's the big thing in particular when you're looking to become a professional coach and move into NBL type roles. It helps to have a bigger coaching network because now you can call on other people. But how did you first get your foot in the door in the NBL sense? Because obviously you do a lot of volunteer work as a coach.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can be hard to make that jump.
Oh, look, it's to get in the NBL a lot, it's about right place, right time, opportunity. You know, I was in an incredible environment working at the New South Wales Institute of Sport, and that provided me a platform to learn from other very, very good coaches. It was very high level. You know, a lot of Olympic coaches there, you know, world champions, gold medalists. So you sort of see what they do. And I was really comfortable is not the word, but everything, it was a learning environment for me. And so I could learn from them and apply things to my own program. And really, you know, it was 10 years. You know, I couldn't believe I was there that long. But during that time, it allowed me to coach the New South Wales under 20 team as well. And we had tremendous success. You know, we won, I think four gold medals, four silver medals and stuff like that, which then by having success at that level allowed me to get into the National Junior Program. So working, you know, in that program there where I became the head coach. So then when I was the head coach of the National Under 20 team, we won the World Championship. You know, and then from the World Championship, that opened doors where I was a head coach to the World Under 20 team for 6 years. And during those 6 years, I'm working with the very, very best players, you know, on the planet. You know, the best international players against the best USA. So again, it's about building a network of people over there, and you know that everything just leads onto something. So an opportunity came up where I got appointed to the National Senior Program with Gorge. So I was with the senior team for 3 years as well. And it was just time. You know, my goal was one day I wanted to be, you know, the head coach of the Boomers. So working in the NSWIS program, which was an amazing situation, I'm only coaching juniors. I'm only coaching under 20s. So if I want to coach the Boomers, the national senior team, I've got to coach men. That's the reality of it. So I basically got word out there that you know, I'd like to do that. And towards the end of my stint at NSWIS, I had opportunities to talk to the Perth Wildcats and talk with Adelaide 36ers, who are the powerhouses of basketball. And for me as a young coach to be able to go from working with elite juniors into the powerhouse program, I think I would have failed.
Yep.
I just don't think I would have had the skills to be able to deal with you know, what the expectations of what comes with a high-profile job. So I was actually then offered a job with West Sydney Razorbacks, and I lived in Sydney at that stage. I was there for over 10 years. I knew the landscape. I was comfortable. At that stage, the club was arguably the worst team in the league. So the expectations between coaching in Adelaide or Perth versus a West Sydney Razorback is chalk and cheese. So they allowed me to cut my teeth. So I took the job coaching West Sydney Razorbacks and trying to implement my beliefs and my philosophy on how I want to develop an organisation. So really it was a case of, it's no disrespect to West Sydney, but I wanted to start at a lower level and see what I could do and I guess fail. Because if you fail at the top, you're done. Yep. It's hard to bounce back from that. So I wanted to really cut my teeth, and that's where I'd coached our national junior program, coached a generation of elite players that allowed me to recruit. The Damien Martins and the Matt Knights and the Julian Kazoos, and the list goes on. There's a number of players.
It's really interesting. I mean, there's not many people alive that can say they've won a World Championships gold medal, and that's obviously a huge achievement in itself. But with that can come the ego of, I've achieved so much here and I really want to jump in. And it's really interesting that you said that you thought you may have failed with an Adelaide or a Perth type job. Did you realise that at the time, or is it something looking back on now, it's like, okay, I've really done the right thing here?
Yeah, there's no doubt. Yep. I honestly think I probably would have failed because I wouldn't be able to handle the expectations of media, of fans, of sponsors, of the ownership group. And that's what a lot of people don't get. I mean, I get it now because I'm at the back end of my career, and it's really, really tough. And if you don't have those skills, as I said, it's not about the X's and O's. I mean, I know I can coach offenses, defense. There's so much more to how to deal with people, emotion, all of those types of things. So, and I didn't have the skills back then, and I had to develop them over times. But so I did 2 years in with West Sydney/Sydney Spirit and learned a lot, so much. Like the club folded, became like the general manager of the club, type of thing, and did roles that I have never done before, which probably prepared me for Perth.
Yep. Absolutely. And I mean, how did that come about? Like, you've gone from, like you say, probably the worst perceived team in the NBL to head coach of the Perth team. That's a massive turn of events.
Yeah, I mean, we did really well at West Sydney. I think my first year, we went from, four or five wins, like when I took out four or five wins to, I think it was 10. That sounds bad. Our record, I think, was 10 and 20. But in my mind, that was success.
Yep.
We had the youngest team in the league, the lowest budget, all of those things. But what we did, we competed. And that was the thing. We every single player, we taught them how to compete and stuff like that. And then we were actually doing exceptionally well. I think we were around 10 wins in the second season. But then our owner walked out on us. So it crashed, and I lost four players. I lost, my imports. I lost, four players. I'm down to six players, and got players from the state league. And I think we only won maybe two games the remainder of the season, but we got credibility.
Yep.
Like people looked at us and saw, hey, that group, although we lost, we actually won.
Yep.
If that makes sense. Just because of the attitude and the never die hard. And I think that there opened up the opportunity at Perth that Perth were looking for a coach. I was without a job. I'm good friends with Andrew Vlahoff, so that helps. So he sort of steered me towards it. And I met with Nick Marvin and Jack Bendat, the board, and sort of outlined how I wanted to do things in Perth, and they liked it and they backed me.
How did you sell it to your players at West Sydney, where you're a young group, perceived, as Rob said and yourself, that not the most talented group, but how did you sell it to them to keep rocking up each week, keep giving everything they've got and keep developing with maybe not the incentive of knowing that they're going to walk in and have a chance of getting the win that week? How did you get them to? Did you change what was a win for your team, or did you was it a result of a lot of conversations? So how did you sell it to them?
Yeah, the thing is, whenever I get players, you know, I've got to get people with the right mindset, with the right attitude. You know, if they're just to win, if you think about it, I mean, there's only nine teams in a league. Well, you've got eight losers. Yeah. You know, so you're going to lose like at the end of the day. And I've never looked at my career as, oh, you got to win. You know, it's not about, you know, I refocus it and go, are you better? You know, so I'd always look at the, you know, any valuation wasn't necessarily about the win or loss, because there was plenty of games that we won that we were terrible and we did not, you know, play well. We didn't play together. We didn't give our 100%, but we won because we were talented. So I always try and change the mindset that, you know, at West Sydney, there is no expectation to win. So there's no pressure. You know, my expectation is that we're going to compete. We're going to give ourselves every single opportunity to win, but sometimes you can't win because they're just better. Yep. And that's what you've got to try even sell to you know, the Perth Wildcats, where they think that you have to win every single game. And please explain. Sometimes you get beat by better teams. It's simple as that. So really, in any time that, you know, the West Sydney days, was there was no expectation. You're open with your communication to everybody to say, hey, we're not expecting to win too many, but we're going to be diving on the loose ball. We've thrown our bodies on the line. You know, we're going to challenge every shot. You know, so we refocused on what we were trying to achieve and use that as a win. You know, there could be games where start of the season you lose by 30. Next time you play them, you lose by 10. Mm. That's a win. You know, that's a win. You know, and that's the whole thing, if you can sell that type of mindset.
That's a great lesson for a lot of junior coaches too.
Absolutely.
Who, let's face it, probably don't have the same level of talent that obviously is an NBL team, but across the league there's usually one or two teams that stand out, and then there's a whole bunch of them that are making up numbers. But to be able to sell that message to junior athletes as well is incredibly important, because now they keep going and working. They don't just, oh, well, we can't win, so we're just going to chuck the towel in and we won't bother. It's trying to sell to them that there are still wins that you can get out of this that aren't necessarily scoreboard related. It's a huge point, I think, for a lot of their junior coaches that are listening to this, is it's not about the scoreboard. Like, the scoreboard's nice and it can get you hired and fired, don't get me wrong, but in most situations, it's just make your kids better. Like, I think that's a message for all coaches. The Perth experience, I mean, that's a really wild ride. I mean, you've gone from having a fairly low budget to obviously more of a budget, access to better players and the like. You've brought a couple of your West Sydney guys across to play in the Perth. I mean, that's a championship and making the final, what, two out or three out of the 4 years there. That's a huge change from what you were dealing with. What was the Perth experience like over there?
Yeah, I guess the difference between the organisations, I mean, obviously it's resources, and but I think the key to the best organisations, they've got the money, but they utilise the money in the right way. So sometimes you can go out and buy the very best players. You know, you go out, I mean, you look at teams over the years that they just blow the, you know, the players that come out, but they it just doesn't work. So what I did was, when I got to Perth, was we had the resources, but it was about building an infrastructure. So, you know, what we did was, I needed to have great assistant coaches. You know, I needed a full-time strength conditioning coach. I wanted our, you know, physios traveling on the road all the time. You know, so all of our preparation was, you know, I bring in Birdie. You know, we have the ability to bring in the best people. We've got nutritionists, we've got psychologists, we've got, you know, they're not full-time, but, you know, we bring those people in. So we generated a program of excellence that I describe as, it's athlete-centered. So it was all about the athlete, and it was driven by me as the coach, and it's supported by the management. So athlete-centered, coach-driven, administrative-supported. So that was the sell to the organisation. So it was set up the infrastructure, get the right players. You know, that's the biggest key. You know, you look at, you know, kids that, you know, they're worried about the scoreboard and, oh, we're going to lose, we're not going to put the effort in. I probably wouldn't select them, because I want people that want to be motivated to compete every time. So I select the players with the characteristics that self-motivated, great work ethic, great, you know, high character. You know, so when we lose, it's not about them. You know, they're committed to each other. So really it was a case of Perth was I had the ability to build the infrastructure with great staff, you know, all the little bells and whistles of having sports code, you know, of having other people to do the data analysis, developing a good network, and then bring in really high quality people like your Damian Martins and your Kevin Lishes and Sean Redditch, and all of those people are, you know, they're very, very, you know, high character people.
How big an impact is Damian Martin on your coaching career? I mean, that's someone that still plays at an unbelievably high level despite numerous injuries and things like that. How big an impact did he have on your coaching?
Oh, look, he's a winner. You know, it's that's the whole thing. When you go all the way back, when I first saw him, he was around 16 years of age, just playing in, you know, a schools competition up at the Newcastle. I think it was the first time I ever saw him, and there was just something there. Like, he couldn't score. He was one of the worst offensive players I've ever seen, but he was everywhere. You know, he was high energy. He was so hard with everything he did, denying the ball, rebounding, stopping people. If I said, don't let him catch it, well, you're not catching it. You know, he just had that mindset, and that became contagious. That, you know, when I convinced him to give up playing rugby league. So no matter what Damo was going to do, he's probably going to play for Australia, whether it was rugby league, rugby union, cricket, basketball. He was this exceptionally talented kid. He was a country boy. So played multiple sports and stuff like that, and just an incredible family that supported him, and so he was very, very I wouldn't say unique, but special in the sense that it was never about him, that he would set the standards with what he would do, and he would raise the bar to everybody. You know, he would call anybody out because he's the one that would put his body on the line. You know, so he's never going to ask you to do something that he doesn't do. You know, so that's what's probably separates him from the others, is that he's probably, you know, one of the most influential players in the NBL. Simple as that.
Did you really convince him to come to basketball and quit playing rugby at McDonald's?
That's right. Yep. Yep. So he lived up in Gloucester, up in the hinterland, northwest of Sydney. And I was based in Sydney, so I drove up to Raymond Terrace, which was almost halfway, so up Newcastle way. He drove down with his dad, and that was it. Just painted the big picture about, you know, I told him, I said, you can play for Australia. You could be an Olympian. Yeah. You know, you could do this. And, I think he went away and, rang back, I think, that afternoon it might have been, and saying, hey, I want to play basketball.
Australian sport, thanks you for that. Yeah. It's, you know, we're very lucky to have seen someone like him, in all honesty, play in the NBL for as long as he has. I mean, that's a phenomenal career he's got to this point, and even internationally. Like, he's one of those guys where everyone will probably sit there and go, gee, do we really need a Damian Martin? It's like, absolutely we do. Like,
yeah, he shut, I think, Kevin Durant down to 25. You know, that's the thing. You know, you need to have people like your Damian Martins and your Kevin Lishes on your team because of who they are as the character side of things and how they bring people together. They're the glue of a team.
Do you think that character can be taught, or do you think it's something he just innately had?
I think he innately had it, but you got him in the right way.
Yeah.
You know, I think, I always talk to our players about what's your strength? What are you great at? What makes you different from other people? And his was defense. You know, going, I want you to be the best defensive player. You know, and I want you to be the best lane runner. I want you to be the best rebounder, the best screener. So when you can define that with your players and give them the confidence to do that, that they can be a master in that area rather than a jack of all trades. Mm-hmm. I mean, our job is to obviously teach multi-skilled players and do that, but you've got to have what is your X factor, what separates you from everybody else. So in Damo's case, innately, he's always been a leader. So really it was continuing to push him to know that that's your greatest strength, you know, is your leadership.
In terms of leadership, I guess all coaches come up, and someone like a Damian Martin could probably make this a lot easier because he might jump in before you have to. But how do you handle tough conversations with role players that maybe think they're a little bit more than a role player, that are maybe not as accepting in the beginning of being that role player, because every team needs them. We can't have, we can have a team of 10 superstars. There's only one ball. So,
and one budget.
Yeah. But how do you have that conversation of this is what we need you to do for the team, and how do you get them to buy into that?
To me, it's funny, like The Last Dance, I think probably it's been one of the best documentaries to look at that. Jordan, he didn't win any championships for many, many years. He is the alpha dog. It's simple as that. He's the kingpin. And until he actually had great role players around him that they knew what their job was, that's when they became really successful.
Yeah.
When you bring in Pippen, you bring in Rodman, you got Luke Longley playing a role, Steve Kerr. And really what we need to educate the young kids about is you be the best role player you can possibly be. Now, if your role player happens to be the scorer, you go and be the scorer.
Yeah.
I look at Andrew Bogut. I've coached for many, many years. And at the World Championships, he was the MVP of the championship. I think he averaged like 28 points and 17, 18 rebounds a game. He was unbelievably dominant. And then, he went to college and, he can flat out score. But now if you look at the back end of his career, he hasn't had to be that scorer. He knew what his role was out there. So when he was at Golden State Warriors, he didn't have to shoot because he had people like Steph Curry, Klay Thompson.
Yep.
And again, he adapted his game. Exceptional passer, high IQ. So he knew that, okay, in this team, it's not about me. It's about what can I do in my team to be the very, very best player. And, Bogut, the amount of times that he would set screens for Steph Curry. That's all he did, screen, rebound, pass. That's why they won a NBA championship. And players like that, once you accept your role and accept who you are in the team, that's when it happens. So if there's too many alpha dogs, exactly what you said, if there's too many people in that team that have got too many egos, it's not going to work. That's part of your criteria.
So that comes down to just your recruiting strategy and ensuring you've got those people or those the character in the athletes that will accept that, hey, Steph Curry is the alpha. We want the ball in his hands as often as possible. Yes, you can score, but that's maybe off a rebound and put back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, honesty.
Yeah.
You've got to be honest with the players. And, a little thing I do with, state teams, I've done 15 national championships. I've done a lot. And you turn up to trials and you've got 100 kids at the trial. Now you've got 100. and so right at the very start, I'll say, okay, there's 100 people here. I've got 10 spots and 2 reserve spots. That's it. I want all of our ones. You go over here. If you think you're a one man, you go here. 2, 3, 4, 5. So I split them up into 5 groups. And then I say, have a look at the person next to you. They're not going to make the team.
Yeah.
No, they're not going to make it because there's 100 people here for 10 spots.
Yeah.
So you have to have something special. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for, hard workers, great attitude, unselfish, great work ethic. Here's the selection criteria.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm looking for people. So, little things of, okay, let's hustle in. Let's go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I look at who's last.
Yeah.
So if you're last, guess what? I remember that person.
Yeah.
But I also remember, you're on 2 or 3 calls, blow your whistle, and they're all running in. I'm looking to see who's first. You can do little things like that sort of separate people, because ultimately when you're in a team sport, when you've only got X amount of spots, good people miss out. Yeah. And I find the difference between the good and the great is the attitude.
Yeah. It's funny. I had a situation similar to that where a young male athlete came and asked, he was going to his first ever state trial and was really excited about it. And unfortunately I knew he wasn't going to make the team. But the aim was to just get through as many weeks as possible and get down to as close to making the team as possible. And my advice was find, at the time, Abby Akintola, get on his team and get him the ball. And that will make you, as a point guard, and that will make you look better because that kid's making the team. There's no question about that. So if you can be seen as somebody who can facilitate to the superstar or the, you know, the alpha dog of the team, then that will help carry you through further weeks. And I think he made it through until about the week before they then cut for East Coast. So, yeah, definitely looking just outside of always being number one, I think, is really important for athletes, but also important for coaches to, like you said, be honest and let them know this is how you could be successful in whatever team it is that they're striving to be successful in.
Well, and I think that really sort of sums up the Perth Wildcats DNA over the years too. Like in your time there and obviously in Trevor's time there at the moment, they've just got a great history of having glue guys. Like they've got their superstars, no question, but there are also guys that just play a great role around that. And obviously, like Greg Hyers just recently retired.
Jesse Wagstaff,
who you're not sitting there like Robbins. Like he was like the ultimate glue guy. And it's like, well, you know, he will just do whatever you ask. Like if you need him to go and lock someone down, he'll lock someone down. He'll stick a three out of nowhere where you just think, geez, where did that come from? Like, but he's that sort of guy. It's just a great DNA to have as a club. Is that something you think you can have an impact as a coach on, or is that something
absolutely
that's instilled?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You define what you want. Yeah, that's why you recruit those players. Yeah. You know, when you're looking at those people, you know, I want to have a Jesse Wagstaff on the team. You know, people whinge and whine, he's this, he's that. No, mate, he's smart, he's articulate, he gets it, he knows his role. You know, he's, you know, Greg Hyer, you know, he was, you know, the ultimate role player and exceptional leader as well. And I mean, in his case, the reason I brought him into the NBL was, you know, at 6'5", he was one of the best rebounders. And we call him T-Rex. He's got short little arms, non-athletic, but he comes up with the ball because of his attitude and his hard work. And I wouldn't say it was a mistake, but what had happened was one of the years I had him, he then wanted to become, you know, probably more than what he was, like a three-point shooter, you know, like more of a scorer and stuff like that. And sort of neglected about who Greg Hyer was. So Greg Hyer, he's your glue player. He's your rebounder, your possession winner. So players like that had to be reminded. I wanted him to shoot the three. I want them to develop those skills, but always go back to what are you absolutely great at and comfortable in your skin. And once Greg sort of realised, oh, this is me. You know, I'm an agitator, Brad Robbins. You know, those types of players, that's how you get a job.
For sure.
That's absolutely right. It's a very different situation from your time at Perth, obviously, to the Hawks. Like it's, I mean, different budgets and all those kinds of things back home in New South Wales, which is probably a nice thing as well. But how do you go about putting together a roster in that situation as well, where you're not dealing with such a high budget, so to speak, but you're now looking at your glue guys not necessarily being your glue guys, but potentially being your stars as well?
Yeah, I mean, that was, again, another scenario that, I was in the penthouse, you know, at Perth, an amazing experience and stuff like that. And then I left Perth and went overseas. You know, I wanted to, you know, just do some different things. And the Illawarra job came up. And to be honest, it didn't really interest me. You know, I thought, you know, I don't know if I really want to do it, but then I decided to because they were at a stage where, they were rock bottom. You know, they've been up and down, you know, like their last, you know, 20 years at least. So really that was more of a challenge for me as a coach to think, can I keep this afloat? Now, can I keep it going? I wouldn't say it was a social experiment by any shape of the imagination, but it was like, okay, the principles that I've applied at West Sydney and what I've seen with other organisations, what I see at San Antonio, and, you know, I look at successful teams, what they do, and it always comes back to, okay, you may not have the biggest budgets. So the difference, you know, over in Perth, you've got budgets, one, to get players, but it's not necessarily about spending top dollar on the players. It's spending top dollar on the environment to make them successful. So that was my model that I've always worked on. So I said, okay, I'm going to do Illawarra. Yeah, they don't have the money, but I've got to have great people. I've got to go in there. So really it was, I went in and thought, okay, well, I have to have great strength conditioning, great medical staff, those people that can help people to develop. You know, I'm known as a developer. So when I'm recruiting, people know that I'm going to make you better. You know, so, but I also had to recruit people that, that I knew would give their heart and soul, Kevin Lish, Kirk Penny, you know, like, the, you know, tap them on the shoulder. And it was like, hey, you know, let's do this. You know, let's see what we can do. We went from, you know, 5 wins in the first season to 17 in the semi-final. You know, it was going based on this is what works. You know, and the following year, you make a grand final. This is what works.
Absolutely. That's a phenomenal turnaround when you really look at it like that as well. But it's amazing the impact one or two people can have on an organisation. And you've mentioned him a couple of times now, but and he's only just recently retired, but Kevin Lish. But what makes him what he is? Is he similar to Damian Martin? Is he just a fantastic leader, or are there just some other intangibles about him?
Yeah, totally. You know, he's very much like Damian Martin. Damian Martin's like a hopeless human being in the sense that he loses his clothes and his car keys and, you know, everything like that.
I mean, he pulls people out hopeless. Of burning buildings, though.
He's done that a few times. Yeah, he's the superhero. But, yeah, Kev, you know, is the same mentality. You know, like white line fever, when he steps across that line, you know, he's a killer. Off the court, he's just a beautiful human being. And, you know, and when I recruited him, you know, I recruited him, you know, out of St. Louis where he was with Rick Majerus. You know, so anybody who can play for Rick Majerus, you know, for a long period of time, you know they're mentally tough, you know. So, you know, he was really easy to recruit. And you need to have those people that have that mentality of wanting to be a killer on the court and great off the court.
When you were in the season with 5 wins and you're implementing your philosophies and your style of play and all of your processes, did you ever have any doubts of, you know, are we heading down the right track? Should I be sticking with this? Or did you start to think maybe I should try something else here? Or and if you did, how did you stay with what is you and what is your philosophy for a team?
Yeah, well, I've never had the 5 losses. That's where that's when I took over.
Oh, okay.
I took over there, but I guess, you know, when I look at the teams that I've had that have had that poor loss, and you've got it's almost a sales job to the players, and really it's about having fun, you know, and doing it the right way. You know, like, you know, I don't believe, you know, I rack my brain if I've ever fired a player like during the season. I think maybe one in, you know, 25 years because, you know, they're just really bad, bad people. Not nothing to do with the skill level because I select the players. I've got to back them. And I think that the players know that I've got their back. And that's the whole thing is, you know, selling a system of play that's fun. You know, and allowing them the freedom. I'm not a dictator of a coach. You must do this. If you don't do that, and let them play with fear. You know, I'm the opposite end that if you don't shoot that shot, I'm going to sub you out.
Yeah.
You know, so I sort of flip it around and get them to understand that why did you start playing sport in the first place? Why did you play basketball or whatever your chosen sport is? It was because you had fun. So sometimes you've got to go back to that. I got caught up in my life of trying to solve all the problems of the world for the players and whatever else. And, you know, it does affect you. It's a real grind of trying to be a people pleaser and trying to, you know, fix everything and stuff like that. So there's no question you have your doubts. You know, sometimes you've got people, oh, you should do this, you should do that. Yeah, and part of my inner circle, my mentor group, that I might have a coffee and going, hey, you know, geez, we're losing. I don't know what they're doing. And they sort of slap you in the face and just say, hey, do what you do. You know, you go back to why did you win all those championships all those years ago? Why have you always had a, you know, successful teams? You know, why do, so you got to sort of reframe your mindset to think, you know, maybe I do know what I'm doing. You know, and not second guessing yourself and, And that, you know, I've learned that along the line. I've had a great psychologist friend that teaches the skills of coping with pressure and the travel and lack of sleep and the bullying and the harassment. You know, you got to learn those skills. And I said that's part of it. The coaching is more to than just the X's and O's. It's how you actually deal with different situations.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially at that level, the amount of criticism and I suppose armchair experts that know how to do it better or think they know how to do it better. So being able to block them out, I think, is a really big part of coaching at every level. We have it even at the junior level, at state team level, especially in Victoria with state teams. You know, if you're not winning by X amount of points, then you're not a good coach all of a sudden, regardless of what you're playing against. So I think learning how to have those coping mechanisms and the ability to just shut out the noise and focus on what makes you and buying into the plan that you have from the beginning. Because if you've sold that to players and then you turn around and flip it on them, that'll go a long way to breaking trust in a relationship.
Yeah, and I think also expectations with parents. I think that's huge. Like always, paint the big picture. I like to have parent meetings and make them feel inclusive, and so they know what we're doing and we're trying to do the best thing for your kids. I think that's something that's really, really helped as well.
Yeah, sure.
Identifying the young talent, like the year with the Hawks, like Emmett Nair, Daniel Greeter, like very different pathways for both of those guys. So Emmett obviously went through the college pathway and was fairly well known coming out of St Mary's, but Daniel Greeter was a little bit of an unknown until he was fairly late in his basketball and career. How did you recruit those two guys to fit, given they were so young but with different backgrounds as well?
Yeah, look, again, it comes to relationships. When you do it a long time and you get known as a developer of players, that helps. People know that you're going to do that. But Daniel Greeter, I knew him from the Perth days. He played in the same team as my son. So I had that relationship. And it was pretty easy for the parents say, hey, I got your kids back here. Send him over here. We'll make sure we look after him, on and off the court. Emmett Nair, I actually worked with his dad, Tony Nair, back in the 2000 Paralympics.
Okay.
So all those years ago, and we've stayed in touch through the years. And, really it's, when you recruit players, you go down to Canberra, you meet people, introduce, you just, I guess, show who you are. And that's part of the recruiting process.
How hard was it to not just throw them to the wolves in that first season? Because they had some games early on in particular where they were really good and they contributed to wins and things like that. How hard is it to not overdo it with them, given they are so young in the league?
Yeah, it's an apprenticeship. Like you explain to them, you're serving your apprenticeship. If you're a chef, it takes you 4 years, an electrician or whatever it might be. It takes time. So really, you surround, it's a combination of having really good mentors, like the senior players, like your Kirk Pennies, like your, whoever it might be that has the ability to grab that player and put them under their wing. So I think it's a combination of get them to understand that there's a process that, your first year you might only play 10, 12 minutes, you might play a bit more, some games a bit less. Really, you got your veterans that'll look to lead the way and see what happens.
Awesome. Going to take a little bit of a shift to the international side of things more than anything else at the moment. It's 16 years between the gold medal with the under-20s and then the bronze medal last year with the World Uni Games team. What were the big differences between the two tournaments? How did the game change in that time internationally?
Yeah, I didn't even realise it was that long and stuff like that.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, sorry, mate.
Well, you look at, the junior stuff, like I was embedded in that world for such a long time with all the under-20 state team stuff. And, you've actually got 2 to 3 years of preparation, towards thing. So there's a whole lot of skill development. You know who's who in the zoo. They all go to the AIS and blah, blah, blah. So there was a sort of a pathway there with those players, and ultimately it ended up winning a world championship, which led me into the men's basketball. So getting into the senior team, and that sort of took me away. I did the 2004 Olympics and the 2006 World Cup. So, I was still involved there. But then when I got into the NBL. I was really, really focused just on trying to get my career right in the NBL before jumping in. And I've always loved international sport. I mean, it's so different. Like tournament play, World Cups, Olympic Games, things like that are completely different to seasonal play. And I've done, as I said, I've done 15 national championships in the past. So I've done a lot of tournament play, you know, with a lot of success. Then I've done a lot of seasonal stuff in the NBL, which has, you know, been, you know, fair as well. But when the opportunity came up with the World University Game, it was something that it was just missing in my life, and I wanted to do it really bad. You know, so it's big distance between it, but they're just totally different types of thing going to, you know, coaching in Scotland in the Commonwealth Game, which is tournament play, which I, you know, I feel I'm pretty good at, and also the World University Games tournament play. So it's like it's like test cricket versus one day cricket. Yep. You know, they're two different types of games.
What do you think are the most important things to focus on when preparing a team for tournament play?
Recovery. I think the physical side of thing. I think you really got to be good at monitoring your workloads. That was part of my journey. Was I had to learn about the physiology, the biomechanics, all those sports sciences, and working with Birdie and working with really good medical physical and relying on those people to give me the feedback. Planning. You got to be meticulous with your planning, that you know, what's the end game. What are we aiming for? Yeah, and I look at national championships, like a lot of teams come out, ball at a gate early in the week. And generally the teams that win championships aren't necessarily the best team talent-wise. It's the team that's best prepared. There'll be games where, you're up by 30. Well, why am I playing my best player? Yeah. So I'm not going to play. I'm going to play all 10 players. So I've always been, I've got to play 10 to 12, to make sure that by the back end of the week in a tournament play that we are physically and mentally ready to go. You've got to do what you've got to do. You've got to know what games you've got to win big. You can win, that type of mentality. So there's a lot of strategy involved, and planning is probably the thing. But, the physical planning the recovery is paramount. And getting the players to actually understand that. Again, it's leave your ego at the door. Sometimes, your best scorer wants to lead the tournament. Maybe the parents want them to lead their kids to lead the scoring. But you play him 35 minutes a game, he's going to break down. So it's an educational type thing for the players most of the time. Why are we doing this?
Do you think spending time from an on-court perspective in preparation to tournament play, do you look at, say, from a national junior team perspective, for instance, we're aiming to play the US, if all things go right, we're aiming to play, say, the US in the final. Do you prepare, I guess, your team rules, like, for instance, your on-ball D rules or offensive structures or whatever it might be, do you prepare those for that in preparation for that game against the US, or do you just put in what you believe will work with the group as best as possible and then just drill down on that?
So I look at when it comes to scouting or systems, it's the team that has the best systems going to win and can stick with it the whole time. So, for example, from a scouting perspective, I don't go out and, they're running the shuffle, they're running flex, they're running horn set, they're running whatever. I look at what's the end goal? What are they trying to do? So what I do is I put our team into scenarios. How do you defend the side pick and roll? How do you defend the middle pick and roll? How do you do certain things on an offensive rebound? You've got 14 seconds left on the clock. What do you do? What do we go to? What are your rules? So really it was putting a system in play that, again, depending on your preparation time, but you might only have two ways of defending the pick and roll. This is it. Now we're gonna blitz it. We're gonna ice it. We're gonna switch. You might have to say three. You know what? Every single person knows what it is. So I teach a system. Like we all know, you know, in our transition, you know, we're trying to score in the first 8 seconds. Like it's that's, you know, bang, we're going for layups. If we can't get our layup, now we're reversing the ball. We're getting ball movement, and then we're gonna attack them late. You know, everybody knows that system. That's nothing to do with what actual offense you do. It's more of your system of play. So when I'm going in with a team, it's almost like a menu. What's on the menu?
Yep.
You know, so entree, you know, we've got this. Yeah, that's it. You know, we've only got three on the entree. That's it. You know, we've only got three in the main. So rather than being having too much information. So I guess getting back to, I'm not going to focus on the USA down the track. I'm going to focus on how great we are at what we do for us. So under extreme duress, when things go to shit, you know, we go back to, you know, this is what we're good at. This is our staple. This is who we are.
Yep.
This is who Australian basketball is.
How much impact, I suppose, do you allow your players to have into that? Is that driven from, I think we will be best at this, so this is what we're doing, or do you allow the players to have input into that as well?
Different situations. So again, you've got tournament play where you've got less preparation. You might only have, you know, 2 weekends or whatever. Again, it's different with Vic Country and Vic Metro, different situations. Some's camp, some's weekly training. You know, so it's all different. So you can't have just, oh, this is the hard rule. But generally with tournament play, I'm probably more of a, what I call an authoritarian coach.
Yep.
I'll come in and say, this is what we're doing. Boom, here's the rules. As I said at the start of a trial, I'm looking for 2-2, 2-1s, 2-2s, 2-3s, 2-4s, 2-5s. You know, that's it, you know. So you make sure that you're good at that. So I'm defining the actual roles of it. You know, this is what we're doing. You know, 2 simple plays or whatever else. In a seasonal play, you know, for example, in National League or NBL 1 or whatever it might be, where you've got more preparation during the week, you know, NBL, you might have 5 sessions a week. You can do more. You can do more. So I get more input from the players, you know, so we might have 4 or 5 different ways of defending the pick and roll, and they're collaborative. Hey, Damo, what do you think? Kev, what do you think? Sean, what do you think? You know, so I get the players to get their input, and I go, yeah, nah. you know, so I'm like, yeah, no, that's a great idea. Why don't we do that?
Yep.
You know, like there's a story with Damo. There's times where, hey, we're gonna switch or whatever. Doesn't matter. And he's like, no, we're not doing that. I've got this, boys. I want no help, whatever. I've got this. You know, you get back and stay with your man, and he'll get cranky if somebody tries to help him. You know, so really, I allow my players at times to be able to say, no, we want to do it this way. But that comes from being together for a while and having a whole lot of trust. Mm-hmm. How much time, how much preparation? You've got to be more of an authoritarian. If it's a seasonal thing, you've got to be, you're still the boss, you're still the leader, but it's more a democratic type of approach, asking, you know, what they do. That's how I operate.
Yeah, I've always used the title of it's a democratic dictatorship. In the sense that I want to hear from you, but at the end of the day, I need to make the decision. So, I want your input. I, it's not all do as I say, but at the end of the day, I'm the one that gets sacked if we're not very good or you're not getting better or things like that. So, what I ultimately have to make the decision.
How did you go coaching your own kids? Because we do have a lot of parents that coach their kids, obviously, and it can be a real minefield to sort of navigate as well. But how do you go coaching your kids?
Equal.
Yep.
Yeah, I try. Yeah, you know, that I try to be equal as much as I can, and you know, that's the whole thing. And you know, I did coach, you know, my eldest boy, you know, a few years ago in the state team. Like they asked me to do the state team over in WA, and I said, I can't be the selector.
Yep.
You know, like. So I actually removed myself from the selection panel and allowed, you know, the high performance manager and assistant coach and other people. So I actually didn't have the final say in the team.
Yep.
The team pretty much shaped out the way I wanted it to be. But it was like, you know, I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to put pressure or have nepotism on on my own son. You know, so really, I mean, it's a real difficult situation. But you know, I just, you know, he's you know, they're players. You know, I want to teach them as players and hold everybody accountable. You know, I don't care if you're the best player or the worst player. You know, I'm not going to pick. You know, I'll pick on the best player as much as anybody. So I mean, if you make mistakes, our job is to help correct it. It's how you do it.
Yep.
How do you go with the car ride home if it has been a not particularly great session or game? How do you manage that? I guess separating from coach to, because I know when I get in the car, especially if Rob's in the car too, it's bah, 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 and I just don't stop. How do you manage that though? When it's your son?
Yeah, I mean, it's time and place. I don't really do a whole lot of post-game analysis. I try and keep an even keel. So I don't want to, if we lose, rant and rave and carry on. But if we win, like, jump up and celebrate. I mean, you know, celebrate your wins and stuff like that. But I like to do the evaluation without emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, so after the fact, you know, like, you know, won't get in the car. I mean, if it was a behavioural thing, you know, like if I saw something that, you know, I didn't like, you know, I'd rip into whoever the kids were. Yeah. It's just not good enough type thing because it needed to be addressed there. But, you know, overall from evaluation perspective, it'll be, you know, hey, you know, take the emotion away from it, let things go, let's address it the next day. You know, so sometimes, you know, if you got back-to-back games, you just got to move on.
Yeah.
You know, can't dwell on it.
Makes sense. Talent identification, what are you looking for in junior athletes now? You're obviously in a fairly unique position where you get to sort of take a step back a little bit and look at juniors again with a view to, I need to potentially coach this to win on a Friday night. What are you actually looking for in junior athletes with aspirations to move them on to the next level?
Probably different things. I mean, you look at obviously the skill level, the gangliness of the kids. Are they long armed? Are they tall, short, physically developed? All of those little, you know, talent, you know, or physiological types of things. You can look at that, but coachability, you know, is probably one of the real big things. Is you know, the attitude. Do they want to be coached? You know, why are they there? Do they want to get better? That's what I really look at, you know, overall, because when we're looking at the separating the good from the great, it comes down to the mindset of the player. So ultimately, I'm looking at that, but you still got to coach everybody, and you know, I won't, you know, when I'm looking at a selection trial, if there's the kid that's pinching people and pulling their hair and agitating other people and things like that. You know, you got to think, oh, do you really want to have that person in your program for 6 months? Because it could be a real grind day in, day out. But with saying that, there could be a reason behind it.
Yep.
You know, you got to learn about, oh, that kid's a troublemaker, he's a head case. Well, no. What's his personality? What's his home life like? You know, you got to do probably a little bit more research, and that's the beauty of sport, is that you can actually use sport to help people out of bad things to success in life. So a team environment and setting the standards by having that kid there, you can have great peers, you can have strong people, and put the kid that's agitating you that might have a little bit of talent there, put him with your best leader. You know, so your demos or your, you know, whoever it might be, can lead these guys. You know, say, hey, you know, it's not good enough. Listen, you know. So I think there's a little bit more to it, but yeah, obviously you've got your talent ID, physiological side of things. You know, the size of their feet, their hands, their you know, their athleticism. You know, things like that. But coachability, I think, is really, really massive towards that.
Absolutely. Where do you get your coach development from now? I mean, you're someone that's come through a pathway that where you were discussing before, you're more a mentor now than anything else. But what do you still do for your own coach development? How has it sort of changed over the years?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So back in the NSWIS days, where I did, you know, 10 years in that program, we had compulsory personal professional development. So every 2 years, we had to travel overseas. You know, I went everywhere from, you know, Duke, North Carolina, UCLA, through to Serbia, Lithuania, Russia. It just went on and on. So we were forced into professional development. personal development stuff, different seminars, webinars, things like that. When I got into the NBL, and this is what I'm quite critical of, is that everything stops. There's nothing. Everybody thinks that you're an expert. So all of a sudden, I'm an NBL coach, and I'm the expert. I am so far from the expert. You know, so you know, for me, I read a lot of books. You know, I read Phil Jackson. You know, I listen to Greg Popovich. You know, I look at who are the best coaches in the world. What do they do? What does Mike Krzyzewski do? You know, so I do my a lot of my stuff is my own personal professional development myself, because you know I was in the NBL for, you know, 300 plus games, you know, over 10 years. Not once did I have any professional development from the club. You know, so really it's onus back on me as the coach is to do that. And I seek out people. You know, I ring up people. I watch videos. I talk to people. So really that's how I've done it. I get along to Basketball Australia's coaching stuff. You know, I'll go to their conventions when I can. I'll do that. I've done a lot of work over in Asia with FIBA. You know, so I work for FIBA doing a lot of presentations. So I remember in the Middle East, you know, I'm there with the head coach of Germany, Spain, and Japan. So it was a 3-day clinic. I just had my notepad out. You know, so I do my bit, I do my clinic, but then I'm taking as many notes. But then you have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with these guys, and you just talk, you chat. You know, so really, it's, you know, getting back to those relationships that sometimes, you know, as an, you know, I know as an NBL coach, I got next to no personal or professional development the whole time because there's that expectation that you're meant to be at the top of your field. So I had to seek my own.
What advice would you give to aspiring junior coaches? So people that want to follow a similar pathway to yourself and that's come through like the junior national teams and the NBL ranks and the like, what advice would you give to an aspiring coach now?
Yeah, it's to me two different types of pathways. You've got the elite players that have finished their career in the NBL, and I think you'll see a lot of them have gone straight from being NBL into jobs, and they don't have the skills. You know, like they could be great coaches, but you know, I always say you've got to serve your apprenticeship, you know, whether you're a player or you're a coach. So you know, like Brian Gorge, when he finished playing, he coached Ballarat. You know, like Brendan Joyce, you know, he coached, same with Bruce Palmer, Brian Curl, like all of those people, when they finished their careers, they actually went and coached in lower leagues before getting in the top end. So that's one way is that you form players that have been really, really good, serve your apprenticeship by actually, you know, working with somebody in your own program before jumping too high. Second thing is the pathway that I did. Was, you know, I mean, I played, you know, 14 clubs, 16s, 18s, 20s, all the state stuff, did that. But I realised I was never really going to be a player. So I did my, you know, your level one, level two, level three. I coached state teams. I did under 14 clubs. I did 16s, 18s, 20s. So I went through the thing. I did both males and females. So, I mean, a lot of people, you know, I coached in the WNBL for, I think it was 4 or 5 years as well. So a lot of people don't know that. So I've done coaching both men and women, and I learned the trade of doing that. I've worked in development programs. You know, so really what I'm finding is a lot of young coaches want to come through and be at the top of the food chain too soon. And I had that opportunity long time ago of being either with Adelaide or Perth where I would have failed. And I wouldn't have had a career. So really, baby steps, you know, do that team. Like I've got people going, oh, yeah, I've been assistant coach in the NBL. So never coached a state team before. You know, so it's going, well, no, the simple answer is no, because you don't have the full package that's involved to be a coach at a high level.
That's a phenomenal answer.
Perfect.
It's so well put. In all honesty, mate, that's it for me. Mate, thank you so much for jumping on. Like, I cannot stress enough. Actually, I do have one more question. The great Warren Brown. So he hooked us up straight away. What's it like working with Wazza?
It was awesome. It was one of those things. So at West Sydney, Illawarra Hawks, you know, we didn't have the resources to be able to do as much scouting as I can. So, you know, I met Wazza. I knew he was good. I just ran in contact and said, mate, I need this. Can you help? Bang, straight away. So, we've stayed in touch for a while, even the Commonwealth Games stuff.
Yep.
We got a short program. You know, we've got no budgets. We've got next to anything. That was a Cinderella story there. But yep. Wazza did some scouting behind the scenes for us. You know, so, hey, Wazza, can you do that remotely from Melbourne? He sent myself and my assistant coach, Craig Nicol, some stuff because – you know, you look at the Boomers and they had like 10 people, you know, at every venue cutting everything up. And, it was the Rolls Royce where, you know, like there was Wazza. You ring him up and it totally dependable. So he was awesome to work with.
The guy from Safety Beach is worth 10 assistant coaches. That's what I heard. and that's certainly what Wazza will hear. So, no, yeah. Mate, cannot thank you enough for jumping on the podcast. Do recommend the book, When Winning Matters. We'll put the link, as I said, in the description for all the coaches. Do highly recommend getting on board this because looking through some of the resources I've seen already in the webinars, it's a wealth of information for coaches to get better. So please do support it. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a fantastic conversation. Coaches, we might have to put a little proviso at the start of this podcast, like don't listen to this when you're driving because you'll need to be taking notes. And we don't want to be responsible for any TAC problems or anything like that. But thank you so much for your time and good luck for whatever comes next for you as well. And hopefully we'll see you back on court really soon.
Thanks, guys.
Coaches, as we mentioned, highly recommend ordering a copy of the book When Winning Matters. We'll put the notes in the show description as well so you can grab a copy of that. But you can also search for When Winning Matters on Facebook. That was a heck of an interview. It's just the wealth of knowledge that comes from him.
No question. What I love about him is the amount of success that he's had in his career, and he still is so grounded and is a champion of doing your apprenticeship and not trying to jump. We all think, you know, we want to be coaching the highest team, the best team with the biggest budgets, or that we want to coach the Boomers or the Opals or whatever it might be. And his consistent message of just do your time, cut your teeth, that way you can be successful. And the fact that he attributes his success to that, I think, is just amazing and such an important message to all of our coaches.
And super humble. And just so willing to give back. Like, honestly, this started with just a text message of, mate, would you be interested? And he's like, yep, no worries. There was no second thought about this whatsoever. Yeah. But the messages that I personally get out of that was out of control. Like, it's, you know, that is a guy that has coached at every level of basketball, still continues to give back in at the junior level. And we don't get that often. That is someone that I think for a lot of people, we should be aspiring to be a lot more like him.
Absolutely.
There aren't too many people that can get away with being known as one word and Bevo.
counts. Like Cher.
Cher, Madonna.
No, and
Ash.
Yeah. But just his mentality as well of... Like when he said, I was coaching NBL and it was like there was no development, no PD, and I'm not the best in my – or the best version of myself, or I'm not the best coach I can be. And so went out and sourced more personal development, more information to continue to get better. And that growth mindset is just – especially when you're at that level already – is just phenomenal.
And a really good example too of do the best job you can in the job you've got at the moment. I'm sure he had aspirations to go on and do more things. Like he mentioned, like he wanted to be a head coach of the Boomers and things like that.
Yep.
But was really cautious of, I don't want to go and do too much too soon. Like that story about not taking the Perth and Adelaide jobs and making sure that he could do something that he would be able to learn and make mistakes in. That is such a phenomenal attitude because everyone gets so excited about that's my next job and I've got this one for 3 minutes. Now where's my next job coming from? Where it was do a good job where you're at and that will lead to other opportunities down the road.
Absolutely. Not putting a time frame on anything. I'm just going to work the best I can in this role and something else will open up. And as we've seen, it has. He's coached all over the world and won gold medals, won NBL titles. It's, you know, there's something in it.
There might be. And look, to be honest, as much as he was very welcoming to jump into the podcast, he might just be happy to talk to different people. because he was just saying beforehand he spent 39 days in isolation. You know, he was supposed to coach over in the NZBL this year.
Yeah.
Got over there, lockdown and COVID hit, did the time there, did another 14 days when he got back here. I think he's just pretty grateful to see other people.
Yeah, for sure. It's probably a lesson that we should take in Victoria at the moment.
It would be,
just
please.
Stay inside.
Hashtag stay home. It's we can see.
We want to get back to basketball.
We want to get back playing as soon as we can. So, once again, massive thanks to Rob Beveridge for jumping into that. When Winning Matters is the book. Again, links will be in the description as well. Highly recommend for all coaches out there. Once again, if you've got any thoughts from the podcast as well or any topics you'd like us to discuss in particular, you can get us on Twitter with the hashtag TalkingSplit and we'll do our best to get to something as well. Even if there's any guests you would like us to talk to, I'm more than happy to sort of reach out and say, look, you know, someone has said we should get you on the podcast. I'm more than happy to get them in. So that would be greatly appreciated on our end. But other than that, that is it for us this week. Hopefully there's a lot of great information and content you can take out to help with your coaching. But other than that, stay safe. Thank you very much for talking split with us, and we will hopefully catch you guys in the near future.